Good morning. The last time I offered a Torah talk, I was 13 and it was my bat mitzvah. I was too young to know that I didn't know anything, and Buddhism wasn't on my radar at all. This is the second Torah talk of my lifetime, and I'm old enough to know that I know very little. I'm a dabbler in both Torah and Buddhism, with a bit more life exposure to the Torah side of things. I hope that after this talk, you'll correct me and broaden my unscholarly understanding. Whenever I encounter a Torah story, my first reaction is almost always, "What? This is inscrutable. Korach, this week's Torah portion, is no different." From the commentaries I read, I learned that the rebellions we've seen in the desert so far have arisen from the fears, anxieties, and discomforts of the people of Israel. The Korach rebellion, in contrast, is mutiny by the elite. 250 prominent male community members, instigated by Korach, a Levite, and incited by Datan and Aviram from the tribe of Reuben, march themselves before Moses and Aaron and challenge their authority. They basically say to Moses and Aaron, "Who do you think you are? What makes you think you're better than the rest of us?" Moses is stunned. He says to Korach, "Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh has chosen you to serve the community, and demanding more. In demanding the priesthood and attacking Aaron, you are defying Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh." Datan and Aviram, for their part, engage in rank demagoguery, accusing Moses of taking the people of Israel out from a land flowing with milk and honey only to die in the wilderness, as if Egypt was the promised land. After this, there's a succession of jolting events. A new creation that swallows Korach, his people, and possessions into the dismal, joyless underworld of Sheol. A fire that consumes the 250 rebels. Something about the repurposing of incense pans. A plague that kills 14,400 individuals before Aaron manages to stop it. All of this utterly fails to bring the people of Israel to see things as Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh commands. So Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh sets up a very different kind of test to establish once and for all who's who and what's what. This is the test. Moses is to collect one staff from each of the 12 tribes of Israel. On the staff from the tribe of Judah, he is to write the name Judah. On the staff from the tribe of Joseph, he's to write the name Joseph, and so on. On the staff of Levi, however, Moses is to write the name Aaron. Moses is then to place the staffs in the innermost sanctuary. Moses does all this, and Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh then decrees that the chosen Holy One will be the one whose staff blooms. The next day, a single staff has miraculously sprouted blossoms and ripened almonds. It is the staff of Aaron. Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh then affirms that only Aaron, his sons, and the tribe of Levi are to approach the temple and do the priestly tasks, for which the Levites are to be compensated in tithes. The people of Israel accept this outcome. The violence in this story is tough to take. But perhaps the Torah is pointing to what it feels like to live through a community-shattering rebellion. Maybe the Torah is acknowledging that before a people can build a just society, they must first hold and cradle their own trauma. So what was this rebellion, and can we connect with how it may have felt? Like many commentators, Rabbi Jonathan Sacks homes in on Korach's intentions. There was not the slightest attempt, Rabbi Sacks writes, to set out the real issues. a leadership structure that left simmering discontent among the Levites, Reubenites, and other tribal chiefs. A generation that had lost all hope of reaching the promised land and whatever else was troubling the people. There were real problems, but the rebels were not interested in truth. They wanted power. Sachs continues, their aim was to discredit Moses, damage his credibility, raise doubts among the people as to whether he really was receiving his instructions from God, and so besmirch his character that he would be unable to lead in the future, or at least be forced to capitulate to the rebels' demands. When you are arguing for the sake of power, truth doesn't come into it at all. Well, all of that should sound familiar. It batters our spirits to realize that the precious community structures we relied upon to keep and protect us were, in fact, heartbreakingly fragile. It disorients us to see an entire nation in peril of disintegrating into hatred and distrust. It can shake our foundations, inflame our emotions, and swallow our hope. I was fascinated to discover that the descendants of Korach transformed sorrows like these into poetry. We learn in Numbers 26:11 that the sons of Korach did not die because, according to tradition, they repented at the last minute. They went on to compose 11 of the Psalms. In Psalm 88, Korach's descendants wrote, I am at the brink of Sheol. You have put friend and neighbor far from me, and my companions out of my sight. I think one of the things this psalm is capturing is that when our own words or the words of others are spoken not in truth and justice, but in distortion and division and egotism, in greed, aversion, and delusion, we break with each other and stand at the brink of spiritual bankruptcy. Perhaps we are prone to be like Korach when we lose touch with our nervous systems and blindly speak and act without first pausing and considering the karma we're about to inject in the world. A commentator named Shaul Yudkevich teaches that Korach was, underneath it all, profoundly hurt. Korach was hurt and insulted because he expected to be nominated to a higher position, and his jealousy infected his worldview. Reubenites like Datan and Aviram were resentful, having been deprived of their birthright. Jacob had given it to Joseph because of Reuben's sexual misconduct. And so they were primed to hear and heed Korach. Jealousy and resentment arise, Yudkevich teaches. The question is, what do you do with them? Yudkevich says that your hurt is your biggest enemy, not the person who hurt you. It doesn't matter if you're right or wrong. The moment you are a victim, he says, you are not connecting to Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh. You are blaming, and someone else is controlling your life. Hurt prevents us from sharing. Hurt blocks our clarity, independence, and creativity. Perhaps our mindfulness practices can transform Korach into our teacher, to help us to know when our hurt has overtaken our tongues. Perhaps our loving kindness practices can help us reconnect to love, to kindness, to gentleness, to Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh. Perhaps we can learn to be people who know how to turn darkness into light and minimize how often we are Korach. In Psalm 49, the descendants of Korach wrote, such is the fate of those who are self-confident, the end of those pleased with their own talk. Sheep-like, they head for Sheol. But God will redeem my life from the clutches of Sheol, for he will take me. How do we redeem our lives from the clutches of Sheol? How do we avoid being sheep-like, unaware of our blinkered self-righteousness, insensitive to the harm we are spreading? Are there tests we can apply that might help us? In Korach, tests came in the form of a new devouring creature, creation, and in the form of a dead staff of wood that improbably blooms. Today, we look not to strange exotic wonders to settle our questions, but to wisdom traditions like Judaism and Buddhism, to our hearts and reason, to truth-seeking discussions with ourselves and one another. Can we devise a test to see when we are and when we are not, in the words of the Pirkei Avot, arguing for the sake of heaven? Here's my stab at it. It's a scientifically questionable little quiz I'm calling, Are You Cool or Are You Korach? Here's part one. Are you arguing to prove you're right? Are you arguing to win? Are you arguing from a distorted sense of honor, from a sense of victimhood? Are you bad-mouthing people? Are you making breezy generalizations? Yes means you're Korach. No means you're cool. Here's part two. Are you arguing for the greater good, putting others first? Are you arguing from love, caring, and kindness? Are you coming from curiosity, not from greed, aversion, and delusion? Are you rising above pettiness, trying, as Rabbi Sharon Henry puts it, to make a moral claim that would lay an obligation not on others, but on yourself? If yes, you're cool. If no, you're Korach. Faithfulness and truth meet. Justice and well-being kiss, the descendants of Korach wrote in Psalm 85. Truth springs up from the earth, justice looks down from heaven, the Lord also bestows his bounty, our land yields its produce. The Korach story starts with the spiritually deadened world of Sheol, barren of faithfulness, truth, justice, and well-being. It concludes with a life-giving staff, sprouting the bounty that conjures a community dedicated to goodness, care, and justice. In a poem about Korach, Rabbi Yael Levy writes, "And deep within the ground, below the shifting sands, Korach and his children lived, listened, and grew. Over time, as the earth shared its wisdom, human beings were created anew. Now the children of Korach sing psalms of praise, raising up truths from the earth, guiding the human heart toward healing." Commentators note that Korach is about recognizing that we have been cast in roles, and it's important that others can rely on us to play them. I'm not talking about unhealthy personality restrictions or stereotyping. There are and should be many ways to be a mother. I'm thinking more like Fenway Park. It's a lot harder to win a ball game if the first baseman abandons his post, if the shortstop wanders off into the outfield, if the batter insists on a tennis racket. Korach's hurt made him blind to the value of his role. His resentment made him believe that the oasis on the other side of the fence was greener. Jewish tradition contrasts Korach's destructive argumentativeness with the idea of arguing for the sake of heaven, exemplified by the earnest grapplings of Shammai and Hillel. The two famously issued opposing rulings on matters of Jewish law. The Pirkei Avot teaches that both schools express the words of the living God. However, the rulings that would guide the law would be the rulings of the school of Hillel. Why? Because we're told the school of Hillel issued rulings that were kind and modest, that gave serious consideration to the rulings of Shammai, and that were stated with humility, discussing the teachings of the school of Shammai before their own. The tradition casts Shammai in a generative role. His role, I think, is to make Hillel's teachings vivid. For example, Shammai taught that we light 8 Hanukkah candles on the first night and extinguish one candle each night pushing us toward darkness. Hillel taught that we add a candle each night, pushing us toward illumination, enlightenment perhaps. The two images together make us think, make the lesson pop. How much less palpable Hillel would be without his friend and foil Shammai. The ancient travails of Moses suggest that leaders have always been lightning rods for human discontent. When a leader has a Shammai rather than a Korach, it is truly a blessing. Several years ago, I was the president of a small community foundation. There was one particular board member named Victoria. At every meeting, whenever she caught my eye, she would smile every single time. Her smile steadied me, helped me manage those meetings more skillfully than I would have otherwise. Victoria was hardly a yes woman, but she used her supporting role not as a stepping stone to self-aggrandizement, but as a platform to lift all of us up. Most of the time, I'm not the leader. Victoria showed me how to be a good colleague to a leader for the sake of the higher purpose a team is called to. And just one more thing before I close. Of the various commentaries I encountered preparing for this talk, I think my favorite is from Cantor Josh Breitzer. He turns music into midrash. I'll call it the midrash of the Pazer trope. The Pazer trope, Cantor Breitzer explains, occurs throughout Korach. The trope, he writes, ascends quickly up the major scale and descends slowly back down, landing on a tone a bit higher from where it started. The word pazer is connected to the Hebrew root meaning to scatter. The medieval Jewish scholars, known as the Masoretes, instituted the Torah trope system that we chant in synagogue today. Cantor Breitzer wonders whether the Masoretes scattered the Pazer throughout Korach as a commentary on the scattering of the community that takes place when people break into factions. The repetition of the Pazer, Breitzer says, might be meant to remind us how close the Israelites came to falling apart because of Korach's uprising. And then, Cantor Breitzer brings it all back to the breath. Throughout the Torah, he writes, the Pazer trope only ever occurs in verses which are longer than the norm. Chanting its elongated melody physiologically requires more breath. He insists, the preponderance of the Pazer trope in Parshat Korach surely carries with it a special significance. For now, I suggest it means that whenever we are feeling scattered, as a community or as individuals, we can always take a moment to breathe deeply, acknowledge our emotions, and bring ourselves back to the present moment. After doing this, what once felt scattered might feel a little more whole. In this present moment, I want to express my gratitude. Thank you for welcoming me to this marvelous, enriching Chavura and Sangha each week. Thank you for this chance to stretch myself and offer this talk. And thank you for listening. I'm eager to hear what you have to teach me about Korach.